From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks for joining me for the weekly wrap-up of Connections. We'll start this week's podcast with a clip from a special program we broadcasted this week in conjunction with Oregon Public Broadcasting and IdeaStream in Cleveland. The joint talk show was on the ripple effect of the opioid crisis, and we spoke with doctors and patients from all three cities and states about the state of the epidemic with a focus on pain management. You can find the full broadcast on our website, and it's worth a listen, so check it out at wxxinews.org/connections. In this clip, you'll hear from two patients who struggle with long-term chronic pain. Michelle Maricos lives in Oregon, and she's a peer support specialist for chronic pain. But first, here's Laura Garrison, our colleague at WXXI, and she's here sharing her pain story.
I think that I've lived with pain most of my life. When I was in high school, I had problems with my knees and everything. And it sort of turned out that as time went on, I discovered that what I had was something that's called inflammatory arthritis, which is my understanding, something slightly less than rheumatoid arthritis, but still very serious. My joints are deteriorating. And in the early 90s, I started to go on medication and try to come up with some ways to stop the pain. In 2001, I had my first hip replacement. In 2003, I had my second hip replacement. And in 2012, I had my third hip replacement. So I've also had several knee surgeries, several shoulder surgeries, all kinds of different things, mostly to try and stop the arthritis. It's now turned into fibromyalgia, which I understand is another common thing to happen. And I'm hearing good news. Eventually, I'm going to get to the point where, you know, all of my joints are tingling and everything. My hands are already to that stage at night. So I live with pain on a regular basis, but it's sort of something that I've gotten used to. It's not a good thing to say, but it's true. And I'm tired all the time. There are things I simply can't do. I can certainly come to work. I can certainly function. I can certainly have a great time. But by the time I get home at night, I'm done. So consequently, I don't exercise. Consequently, I weigh more than I really should. And consequently, that's bad for all of my joints. So what I'm trying to do is work with my doctors to come up with a program that incorporates a lot of different things. I do acupuncture. I do myofascial release with a physical therapist. I do yoga. I do tons and tons of Tylenol, tons and tons of anti-inflammatories. I take Plaquenil to stop some of the problems with my joints. And all of that is effective. But sometimes the pain gets out of control, and I find that opioids are the best way to relieve that pain in an instant fashion.
How often?
Sometimes once every 4 or 5 months. Sometimes it's once a week. It just depends.
Okay, so it's not daily for you.
It's not daily. It just comes and goes. And I use that as a last resort. Certainly, I'm not going to start with an opioid when I'm in pain. And a lot of times, like I said, it's just when I'm in really serious acute pain. And having gone to a pain clinic here in Rochester, one of the things they tell you is stay ahead of the pain. Make sure that you can keep it under control. And when it gets out of control, you got to do what you got to do in order to get it back in control. So I take the opioids.
Are you finding yourself relating to the emails that I read? Are you nervous about losing this as an option?
Well, I'm not, because I have really wonderful doctors who understand that that is part of my medication and have gotten to know me over the years and understand that I'm not abusing it. Prior to my first hip surgery, I was taking Vicodin like it was candy. I think I took 20 or 30 pills a day sometimes. And I was very nervous I was going to become addicted. I had my hip surgery, and I kept on saying, what happens if I'm addicted? And I wasn't. So it's very interesting to me to see what addiction is and it isn't, because I don't seem to become addicted to it even when I'm taking massive doses of it. Now, I have to tell you, it really wasn't very effective. It really wasn't stopping the pain. And so consequently, before my second hip surgery, I just didn't even bother, because it wasn't worth it. Just live with the pain.
Is there a stigma? Do you fear a stigma?
You bet.
There's a stigma with opioids?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it just so happens that Evan and I were traveling to Spain, and I took some opioids. And several people on the bus said, you took opioids? Why are you taking opioids? And it's not that I'm addicted. It's just that I was doing like probably triple or four times the amount of walking and physical activity that I normally do, and I hurt.
Let's turn to another patient. This is in Portland. Michelle Maricos is a patient living with chronic pain she's also a certified peer support specialist for chronic pain. She works with Oregon Pain Guidance. And I want to go back, I guess it was 15, 16 years ago, Michelle. Why don't you tell us what happened to you and what changed your life?
Yes, hi, Evan. Thank you so much for having
me.
Sure. So about 15 years ago in 2003, I had a very bad accident and crushed 3 vertebrae in my neck. And so I kind of started down the road of opioids. The doctors said, okay, well, we're not going to do surgery. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to do, you know, medication. And so I lived on medication for a long time. And then in about 2011, I ended up having some problems with my discs in my neck and had a surgery. And unfortunately, that surgery failed. So I was left in bed on high-dose opioids and pretty much non-functional. So I was at the point of having another surgery, a full cervical fusion, and I was told I couldn't have the surgery because I was on such high-dose opioids. So then I went back to my doctor, said, okay, well, you know, I can't have the surgery until I taper down. And his response was, well, did they tell you how to do that? So I kind of was at this point of, I need, you know, a large hospital system. I need some kind of large intervention. And so I went to the Mayo Clinic, and the Mayo Clinic said, yes, we'll do the surgery, but again, you cannot be on these high-dose opioids. But we do have a program. It's called the Pain Rehabilitation Program, Pain Rehabilitation Clinic. And go to that program, do that program, and call us when you're done. So that program, it saved my life. It truly did. It was a 3-week program, tapering off of the medication, learning about pain, learning about the pain cycle, learning about trauma and addiction versus dependence. And so I was highly dependent on that medication. And being able to get off of that medication and move on with my life and have some life skills that I really could grasp onto that was not the pain medication made the huge difference.
And so now, tell me about the work that you do with other patients, because what you're hearing from other patients who have already written the program today, Michelle, is a fear, a fear of, I've talked to people in my own family in Cleveland, that's where I'm from, who are concerned about what happens if you lose this as an option, or I can't, you know, live without certain medications, certain opioid prescriptions.
So after I ended up coming back from the Mayo Clinic, I ended up being able to work with a group called the Oregon Prescribers Group, and now it's Oregon Pain Guidance Group. And that group is a group of doctors and kind of concerned citizens, and I ended up doing a peer support specialty training to learn how to work with patients and to learn how to, you know, field those questions of the fear, that it is, you know, fear and anger, and that anger is based in fear because it is the unknowing question of what will I feel like if I don't have this medication. And being in that place and being able to help other patients through that place of, okay, we're going to get you the skills and all of the information that you need to be able to live your life on lower doses of medication, not necessarily off of medication, but just lower, safer doses that are reasonable.
And do you think, Michelle, that there has to be a continuing conversation about expectations? In other words, in the last 20, 25 years, when we made pain a vital sign, when we started asking in hospitals about, you know, your pain on a 1 to 10 scale, did we then create this expectation that we will wipe out all of your pain, and if we don't, there's something wrong?
Yes, because there's a misconception of the cure. And I spent years of my life looking for the cure for chronic pain. I never once heard until I got to the Mayo Clinic that there's no cure for chronic pain. And that was a devastating point, but it got me to a point of acceptance of, okay, there's no cure, but I can actually accept living with the pain and having those expectations of get to a place of with your life of living with a certain amount of pain, and then that's okay. And that learning about the medication too, and that how it does cause more pain the higher doses that you get into, and that hyperanalgesia actually creates more pain, kind of was a motivator to actually get off the medication also.
I want to turn back to Laura Garrison, who's a patient here. And, you know, you're hearing from Michelle, who went through a lot. I mean, just hellacious pain herself. And she's saying she's working with people, probably people who have been in situations like yours. Are you persuaded?
Well, absolutely, because that's how it is. You have to understand that when you have a chronic condition, you're going to be in pain. That's just how life is. So the question is what can you do to alleviate the pain? What can you do to get to a point where you can live a, and I'm putting this in quotation marks, normal life and still manage your pain, because that's what it is. It's the management of the pain. And hopefully you've got some really great doctors who are able to help you through it and who prescribe or who are willing to prescribe alternative therapies. My rheumatologist happens to be from Africa. He was trained in Africa. I always like to think that that makes him open to a lot of different things. You know, here in Rochester, we don't have the chance to try marijuana. I'd love to try it. They're not convinced here in Rochester. But, you know, perhaps someday they will be. And maybe there are other things that you can do. So I'm always looking for next things. And I'm not even going to get into the insurance issues with paying for those alternative therapies, because they simply don't, for the most part. You know, even with a prescription, they may pay for a quarter, a third, a half of those therapies, so that you have to be living at a certain level with a certain income just to even to provide those therapies for patients out there. Having opioids as part of the mix is an important thing to me, and I bet it is to a lot of people, but it's certainly not the only answer, and it shouldn't be your first answer.
Next, an update on the crisis in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico's Department of Education announced last week that it will close nearly 300 schools due to a decline in enrollment. The news comes as more families leave the island seeking better lives, and hundreds of families have come to Rochester. In this clip, you'll hear Hilda Rosario Escher. She's the president of the Ibero-American Action League, and she's been helping many families from Puerto Rico get settled in Rochester. Here she is discussing the frustration Puerto Ricans here and on the island feel about the federal government's response to the crisis.
People are frustrated. People are angry, as well as I am. And I was when I was in Puerto Rico. We cannot understand, because we are American citizens and we are treated less than second-class citizens. I mean, the government in New York have been doing more in Puerto Rico than the federal government. And I mean, that is unbelievable to me. I don't know how people can go to sleep at night and not think about what the families in Puerto Rico are facing. When you have people 6-7 months after a hurricane, a disaster like that, and they are still without drinking water and electricity, come on, that's it. United States is the richest country in this world, and we send aid to many other different countries that, you know, that really have nothing to do with us. But to treat American citizens like Puerto Ricans are being treated, it's inexcusable. So, as you can see, I get pretty emotional when I talk about it.
Well, let me read an email from a listener named David who says, Evan, I was struck by the fact that Puerto Rico could be going to replace some public schools with charter schools and vouchers. It seems to me to be fairly typical exploitation of disaster to transfer control of an important public institution to private for-profit hands. Naomi Klein wrote extensively about these typical exploitations of disasters in her book, The Shock Doctrine. Can you or your guests comment on that? It seems to me a very important part of the disaster, education, for the people of Puerto Rico. That's from David. Hilda, are you worried about the closure of schools or what's going to happen with public education in Puerto Rico?
I am. You know, it's very disconcerting to me that they are closing schools, but yet they are going to open charter schools. That really does not make much sense to me. So somewhere in there, there has to be a lot of money involved. So I disagree with the notion of closing schools and then opening charter schools.
The last time I talked to you, you actually were in Puerto Rico. Give me a snapshot for how many families that we at least are pretty aware of that have moved from Puerto Rico to the Rochester area. How are things going here with that?
We have had about 2,500, but that does not count a lot of families that have moved, that have not come to our center. We are still working to resettle like 400 families. So, yes.
And what's the most difficult part of doing that?
The most difficult part is finding housing and transportation. because they come and, you know, basically they don't know where they are. And the other difficulty is the weather, you know. So we have spring coming up, so hopefully they'll...
Allegedly.
Absolutely. At some point, it will get here.
Well, and I know our listeners, as we go throughout the hour, are going to be wondering what they can do to help. There's a couple of things coming up here, but let me just start by asking you, in particular, if you want to help with families... Do families need transportation help? They need places to stay? What do you need most?
The families that we're working with now, they need security deposits for their apartments. So that is a big issue. And furniture.
Okay, so those are two big ones.
Those are two big ones. Transportation, we use Uber.
You use an Uber, okay.
Well, yeah, I am. They come to the center, and then I call Uber and send them back to their hotel or
who's
shelter.
Who's covering the bills for that? Ibero?
Yeah.
Okay. So you need money for... You are. Let's be honest here. Who's covering the bill? You're covering the bills.
For Uber, I am.
Personally?
Yeah.
Okay. So those are some ways that you can help. And if you wanted to get in touch with Ibero-American Action League, how do people get a hold of you?
They can call 256-8900, extension 632.
Do it again. Do it again.
256-8900, extension 632.
Now to a discussion about stereotypes about African Americans in the media and in books. A recent piece in the Atlantic Monthly explored how parents of color are shielding their children from those negative stereotypes, either removing certain kinds of media or introducing other forms of media that can inspire their children in positive ways. In this clip, East High School Superintendent Sean Nelms talks about how he thinks positive forms of representation are on the rise, especially when it comes to books.
I think two things are getting better. One is I think writers are more conscious, and we have an author here and a local author here who's a living example of that. But I also think that social media has allowed us to share things like that. So I know when I posted that image on my personal Facebook page probably 6 months ago, I had such a large response from non-people of color, people who were not black or brown, who said, man, I didn't know these books existed. And so I think sharing information, again, if you have an open and eclectic group of friends, it's our responsibility to share the information with them, share with them resources. They can buy those if they choose in their own home or push their libraries to purchase those texts. I mean, I know that in the city you find many resources in our local libraries, but I guarantee you, if you want to do your own research, go out to suburban districts, because I have with my own children, those same books don't exist. They can be ordered in, but they're not automatically available. And I think that's a huge disservice, because they should be present within those school settings, within those library settings in the suburbs. Because without that, it gives the impression that that history only matters when it's requested. Mm. And it's not something that helps shape our history, our American history.
Let's talk a little bit about reading lists as we get older, because that was a real sore spot for some families that we met about a year and a half ago when we were doing that reporting, who said, we want our kids, this grandmother's telling me, we want our black kids to read the classics, classics by white authors, the classics, by the way, by black and brown authors, and we rarely see that on reading lists.
Absolutely. And poets alike. I mean, I grew up in an era where we read Black Boy by, you know, Richard Wright and Native Son, and my kids are now reading books like The New Jim Crow. There are a ton of books that are available that give a different depiction of history, and I think it's important for all kids of all races to read those texts so they come out with a balanced perspective, as Pastor said earlier. And that's in print and also in media. So Oprah Winfrey did a 60-minute special this past weekend where they took the controversial, I guess they call it a controversial approach to showing pictures and images of lynching. And I remember as an 8th-grade history teacher, I always showed pictures and images of lynching. So kids truly understood that it wasn't just the physical act of lynching, but it was the emotional fear that it put in communities. It was seen as a day of celebration for some in the community. They would get dressed up to come see the public lynching. We're talking 70, 80 years. This is not history that's too far gone. And so I think that literature written and also in digital form, it helps provide all of our kids with a balanced perspective. So every year you see some kid dressed up in blackface in some local college, right? And you're like, at what point do they know that's wrong? Or you see a kid with a noose somewhere. So it happens every year. There's something that either says this is being done intentionally, which I want to assume that the best intentions, or they really don't know. And I think if we take the approach they really don't know, books and digital media is an opportunity to broaden their perspectives and help them understand why it's offensive, but it also helps people who are offended to understand how to respond and educate them differently instead of returning to violence or just dismissing them altogether.
What are they reading at East High?
Right now, we just make sure every kid is reading The New Jim Crow. I think that's a really important book in the Black community around the mass incarceration of Black youth and how policies were set up in the 90s that, you know, led to that mass incarceration, and how the students and people who were incarcerated, or how families were destroyed, how men were taken from their homes, the mental health issues that were associated with drug addiction. I mean, it was done through policy, and it played out just the way it was intended to, and it destroyed large populations of Blacks in the community. And ironically, it's the same thing that's happening now with the opioid addiction, but now it's being treated differently. It's not being treated as something that leads to imprisonment, or people are getting treatment for it. There's, you know, shooting galleries. As much as that's important, and as those attempts are to improve the community, that wasn't happening before when it plagued the Black and brown community. And there are people who are really upset about that. Not upset that people are being treated, but upset that how it was introduced in the Black and brown communities has had generational impacts. And now it's being treated as a disease, and it's being treated as something associated with mental illness. And so within the Black community, you have this discourse around how this issue now, opioid addiction, is being viewed as something less criminal. And in the Black community, it was criminalized. So the new Jim Crow gives kids a different context, as one book by Michelle Alexander, a different context to think about how policy sometimes creates its own reality. And those who are underrepresented often are punished because of it.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. You can also find us on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks for listening, everyone. We will talk to you Monday.